Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting the show today by talking with you about microplastics in the ecosystem of the Great Lakes. And we have a couple of guests who are doing some really cool research looking at microplastics. Heron Wei is an assistant professor in the Environmental Chemistry and Technology program of the UW-Madison College of Engineering. Heron, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in today.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
And with us as well, Jenny Carlton. Jenny is the Education Outreach Specialist for the Wisconsin Sea Grant. And Jenny, it's great to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
As we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. What do you think about microplastics? It's a big issue, as we're going to be finding out here as we talk with our guests. And just to start with, we got nanoplastics, Horan. We've got microplastics. What basically are they? Just to get everybody on the same page here.
So the microplastic is defined as a plastic particle or fiber or whatever stuff, they have a dimension smaller than 5 millimeter. So it's
pretty small.
Pretty small. And for nanoplastic is a particle smaller than 1 micrometer.
And they contaminate and wind up in, I think I saw something like in the U.S., about 94% of tap water. Is that absolutely true, that samples with microplastics?
Yeah, I believe you, Larry, but I haven't seen the paper you read, and I didn't do a lot of experiments now for drinking water microplastic analysis, but I believe they're everywhere.
They're everywhere. Jenny, why? And we need to be concerned about these in the Great Lakes.
Yes, I think one of the reasons we want to be concerned about them in the Great Lakes is that, of course, Lake Superior and Lake Michigan are at the headwaters of our other Great Lakes. And so what happens here in Wisconsin affects all of the sort of downstream lakes, the other Great Lakes as well. And also here in Wisconsin, even if you're not in those two watersheds, you're probably in the Mississippi watershed, which of course flows to the Gulf of Mexico. So Wisconsin has a big influence on what happens to water quality in many other locations besides just Wisconsin.
And the Great Lakes provide drinking water for, 40 million people, something like that?
Yeah, that's about right.
Mm-hmm. And the researchers have found microplastics in blood, even human blood, even breast milk, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, there's a lot of research going on as to where they're occurring and how frequently they're occurring. And pretty much scientists are saying that where they look, they typically find them. The quantities, of course, differ from one location to the next.
And what do we know about the effects on human health? Do we know anything yet? Has there been any research? Or I'm sure there's ongoing research, but have we got anything conclusive on it?
I think the microplastic can cause inflammation, and sometimes it can get into the cells, tissues. But these are all the experimental results from animal-related models. But for human being, you know, it's really hard to conclude any toxicity. I mean, they definitely there are the power of evidence showing the toxicity of microplastics, but it's hard to say anything conclusive for human toxicity.
Yeah.
But yeah, we need more research to investigate that.
Well, if it's turning up in breast milk, I got to believe there's not a parent in the world who wants to have their child drinking their mother's milk that has microplastics in it, or anything else for that matter, other than the real thing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, Horan, your team of researchers has developed ways to detect these very small microplastic particles. How do you do it?
So for microplastic in the Great Lakes, their concentration is about like a, there are two units. So one is about particle number per square kilometer of surface water. So it's super low, it's 5,000 to 10,000. So we have to filter the water out, filter the microplastic out from the water. And once the microplastic are on the membrane, we just do a Raman spectroscopy imaging of the membrane surface. So it's like we shoot a laser onto the membrane at one location, by one spot by spot. We got a map, and we track specific fingerprint of the microplastic. Then we know they are there, and what are they, and what the morphology are they. So our work in this project is to, for my part, is to develop a new type of membrane that can accelerate the scanning rate, because you don't want to spend hours to analyze one sample. It's way too slow and expensive.
Yeah.
So our technology can reduce the scanning time by 100 times or more. So it's like a new type of imaging substrate by taking advantage of unique optical properties of nanostructures. So
that's a pretty cool thing. And in terms of the amount in the Great Lakes, I heard some ungodly amounts. It seemed like to me 22 million tons or something like that.
So annually there are about like 10,000 tons of plastic got transported into the Great Lakes. So this is estimated amount, like 10,000 tons per year. And so a lot of them can be degraded by either sunlight, if it floats on the top, or by the mechanical force, by the waves. Sometimes you have some microbial action. And overall, the big plastic got be decomposed into small ones, smaller and smaller particles. So so actually when I want to start to write a proposal about it, that's because I read an article saying so the plastic got transported to the marine, the ocean, and the plastic we can eventually recover, they have a huge gap. So it seems like a lot of plastic disappear. So maybe one hypothesis is they just degrade it into a tiny little particle that people can not see, and it's hard to measure. So, and then I searched literature at that time. I saw, only a little data exists for this tiny little particle in the Great Lake, which is important water, like drinking water supply and for recreational activities. And so I think that motivated me to develop a method to measure them.
So what type of plastics pollution produces microplastic? What happens there, Jenny?
Yeah, so virtually any type of plastic. You may have heard of Millie Zantel before. PBS Education has a biography about her. She's a Wisconsin resident who created the resin coating system that we use to identify plastics. And generally, we use seven different types. And all of those types of plastics can degrade into smaller pieces of microplastics. As you mentioned earlier, when we do our laundry, if it's synthetic fibers, polyester, rayon, and all different types of things, those can come off in the laundry and go into the wastewater stream, and it's very difficult to remove those particles from our wastewater stream once they're in it. So there's lots of different sources of these microplastics. There's been studies done about tires and on the roads. Here in Wisconsin, of course, we have road salts that can potentially degrade those tires as well. And again, they're looking at a variety of different things, many researchers involved in this from many different angles. We're still learning so much, and there's still so much we don't know. And that's one of the reasons that these are often referred to as emerging contaminants, because we just don't know as much as we'd really like to know about them.
Yeah. And the Wisconsin Sea Grant directed federal funding to Horan's research. And this year, more grant funding from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was awarded to him with a related project that you're working on.
Yes. So the two projects overlap to some degree, because the project I'm working on is designed to work with students at Mount Mary University who are studying in the fashion department. Fashion is, according to the United Nations Environmental Program, the fifth leading, they're responsible for about a fifth of the plastic pollution that's entering the global production every year, and that's a significant amount. And of course, the fashion students aren't actually producing those textiles, but they have influence over what types of textiles are being produced and the products that they're creating and moving forward in their career. So that was one of the reasons we chose this particular group of individuals to work with.
Sure. And this federal research, these federal research dollars, I should say, got to be important for this work.
Yeah, so this money comes from the bipartisan infrastructure legislation that was recently passed. And so it is a significant amount that wasn't available previously. And there are a variety of projects funded all across the U.S., not just here in Wisconsin. And again, they're looking at a variety of different topics depending on the state. Information about these grants are available on the NOAA website if listeners are interested in learning about some of the others. But here in Wisconsin, we received funding for these two projects, and we're very thankful.
Yeah.
We did quite well in this nationwide competition.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super important for my research too. So it, so we need a lot of like investment to build a modular or prototype analytical platform that include the sample pretreatment, like including digestion, filtration, separation, and then we developed a tool to accelerate the scanning of microplastic on a membrane surface. And we need a modular sampler that we can put on the boat, because, you know, each time we need to filter at least tens of liters of water. So it is really time consuming to transport this amount of water to the lab for the analysis. And in the third year of this project, we will go on the boat of the EPA. It's the biggest vessel they have for the sampling on the Great Lakes. So we put the sampler there, and we just do the sampling on the boat. Yes.
Right on the boat. Horan Wei is an assistant professor in the Environmental Chemistry and Technology program in the UW College, Madison College of Engineering. Jenny Carlton is the education outreach specialist for the Wisconsin Sea Grant, as we talk with them about microplastics and the work that they are doing. Questions for you, for them, I hope you'll join in. I see we have a couple of email questions. If you have one, you could email us to talk@wpr.org. If you'd like to join in by phone, that would be great, too. It's 800 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at microplastics on the program today and some really cool research on what's going on with microplastics in the Great Lakes. Horan Wei is an assistant professor in the College of Engineering, Ginny Carlton with the UW Sea Grant Program. Great to have them with us. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Mike in Madison emailed to ask if household cleaners like Bon Ami or Bartender's Friend, do those kind of products contain microplastics? And then sort of, are there resources listing what products include microplastics?
So I don't know the particulars of those specific products.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, small microplastics have been eliminated from consumer products in the U.S. and within Canada based on past legislation. The cleaning products, I'm not sure whether they fall within this legislation, but products of like facial wash and toothpaste that at one time contained small microbeads, they were called. They were basically scrubs to get your skin really clean. They were intentionally put into these products. A number of years ago, they were banned by legislation.
Like the old lava soap, that would probably be an example.
Perhaps. Again, I'm not familiar to say specifically.
I remember it from my younger days. It was kind of grainy, and but it did a good job, but it was a little bit grainy for sure.
Yeah, other things that might be used could be little pieces of sand, you know, natural type products to create that abrasion type effect.
Marilyn emailed to ask whether the coating on dishwasher and laundry detergent tabs contribute to microplastic pollution, or is that a harmless coating?
I have no idea what they're made out of, so I couldn't say one way or the other. Yeah. I hadn't never thought about it before.
Yeah, I need to look it up. Yeah, I don't know the chemical composition of that coating. It could be like a biodegradable materials. It could be just polymer, like synthetic polymer that we consider as macroplastic source, but.
Yeah, we're not sure on that. Let's go to Steve in Cumberland. Steve, hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks. I'm curious about just a summary of what your guests might say the general health hazards are from microplastics in the water. I appreciate your call. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Steve, for calling. We did touched on it a little bit. Maybe, Jenny, we start with you, and Horan, you can chime in, too.
Yeah, so I am not an epidemiologist or do no medical work at all, so I'm not really able to speak to the health consequences of these. And again, I think the main emphasis right now is that we don't really know, right? We haven't really done these studies on human subjects for a variety of ethical reasons. There are animal-based studies that we're looking into and how that's affecting those other species, but we don't really understand the health effects. We also don't understand how much we may be ingesting or inhaling or how these plastics may be entering our bodies in other ways as well. So many unknown things still.
Do they hang in the air? I mean, is this something I could get into your lungs, Horan?
Yes. We got detectable macroplastics in the air samples too. And also I want to follow up with this question. So for microplastics, I mean when their size is really small, they can get into the tissues.
Yeah.
That is known. But for the human toxicity is unknown, because you cannot do any test for that aspect. And also another toxicity of macroplastic is they can absorb toxic chemicals. So they are in the water. They are there for hundreds of years, and then they have a high surface area, and then some toxic chemical like a perfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS, or like a mercury or a PCB, or something like that, mm-hmm. can get onto the surface. And the fish will take this. I mean, so first of all, this there is an unknown which fish will accumulate this macroplastic, right? In this project, we're starting from the benthic, living creatures. So water flea, like a plankton, and also fathead minnows.
Flathead minnows.
Yeah, this different like trophic levels. We're trying to figure out if the microplastic and nanoplastic can get into the plankton, and then if it can biomagnify in the fish, just like a mercury and PCB. So that's what we're trying to find out. And if it is, so we're going to try and find out what type of microplastic can be easier to be bioaccumulated and biomagnified, and what size, how what is the influence of the size of the plastic particles on this bioaccumulation.
Earlier you had asked about the different types of plastic, and because there's different types, they do behave differently. So some of them will float, some of them will sink, and some of them will stay within the middle of the water column. And so it's very difficult to generalize what will happen because it's very dependent on where they're positioned within the water and how long they hold that position, and the organisms that they come in contact with while they're there. So it's a very complex system to try to study and understand.
Yeah, for sure. Penny in Winona County, Minnesota, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Penny.
Yeah, hi, good morning, Larry. So what I wanted to mention, I had recently gotten a new dishwasher. It gave me like a coupon for those pods. So for the first time, I started using them. And then I started thinking about it, and I did look it up. And it said those laundry and dishwasher pods do contain plastic. I thought they were just some sort of biodegradable, you know, dissolvable thing. So I have now stopped using all those plastics and have switched to just a powdered or a liquid detergent that you just add, you know, without any coating.
Whoa, good for you, Penny. That's and if it's plastic, if there's any plastic, it's going to be, it can turn into these microplastics.
Yes.
So yes. Anything with plastic, that's what's going to happen. Penny, thanks a lot for bringing that up. Appreciate it. Bob in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Bob.
Hello. About 10 years ago, I did a tour of the Chicago Water Works, and they said the water came down from actually Lake Superior and was very refreshing. But they also say that it contained microplastics. So my question is, how did it really come from Lake Superior, and how did the microplastics get into it?
Yeah.
So I can listen on the air.
All right.
So the sources of microplastics to the Great Lakes include the wastewater treatment plant effluent. Mm. So we got a lot of daily life waste flow into the wastewater treatment plant, like in the washing or like washer. So you have the textile breakdown into the little plastics. Like you see in your a dryer, right? As
sure.
You always got a pile of entangled fibers, but they can be break into very tiny little pieces and flow into the macro the wastewater treatment plant, and that's a major source. And there's industrial wastewater discharge too, and stormwater runoff. So you got water for example, you got a high in the highway, there's a lot of like particles from tire, right?
Yeah.
And after heavy rain, all this got to be washed off and into the streams, like tributary, and then flow into the Great Lakes. And also, there are some like deposition from air, but there's a minor contribution. So for Lake Superior, I think it's the cleanest lake because it's compared to Lake Ontario or Lake Erie, it's not like they're not like urbanized like area, and it's a bigger than smaller lakes. So the current data shows the macroplastic with a size higher than 100 micrometer is the slowest for Lake Superior.
Yeah, so there was a 2016 study by a person named Heartline, and they were looking at the ability of these wastewater treatment plants to remove these particles. And due to their small size, it's very, very difficult. And again, some float, some settle, some stay in the middle. And their estimates of the researchers were that the water treatment plants released up to 40% of the microfibers they received. So in other words, once it's in there, it's extremely difficult and not cost effective to take it back out. So prevention is, you know, way easier than trying to deal with the problem afterward.
Excuse me, I had a bit of a cough there, but that was my question. You know, how the heck would you filter that? I mean, these are so small. To provide a filter, it was almost you'd have to block the whole thing, Horan.
So that's what we. There's one task we're gonna do in this project to filter out the very, very tiny, like a tiniest portion of microplastic. So far, for the USGS and the US EPA, they have a method that using they call Manta net. So this a net looks very similar to Manta. They put it in the end of the boat and then drive the boat across the lake, and then they can capture plastic particles larger than 100 micrometer, but they cannot detect smaller particles.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why we want to develop like a on boat what we call fractionated membrane filtration module. So we call it fractionated because they have a multiple stages membranes with different sizes, but they're all smaller than 100 micro. And then we can separate microplastic with different sizes by using this module. And then we do an optical scan across all the membrane surfaces. And so we can know small particles. Yeah.
You know, Michael emailed us, and this is kind of invoking the precautionary principle. Don't we know enough to at least ban plastics and used in single-use products like bags and utensils and straws, plastic straws that are put to trivial uses? Don't we know enough about that?
Yeah, so I would say the politics of any product and the use of that product is government policy, and the government policy is up to the people that are electing those people who are creating those policies. So yes, there's information about by researchers, you know, the impacts of these things, just as there's research about the impacts of many other products, cigarettes, you know, all different kinds of things, alcohol, and, you know, the politics of what we allow our citizens to use and what we don't allow them to use is just that, politics. So,
and just to that point, someone sent a note that there's a new bill proposed. This came from ABC7 in New York. There's a new bill proposed in New York City that would ban detergent pods due to microplastics and would make selling or distributing detergent pods or laundry sheets with those with polyvinyl alcohol illegal. So that kind of goes to what you were talking about, Jenny.
Yes. There's also been legislation introduced in California related to requiring filters on washing machines, on new washing machines. So there's a variety of ideas that people are putting forward that may or may not help to address this concern. And I think one of the things that we try to strive to do is inform people, you know, about the research and the educational efforts that are going on so that people can either make personal choices in their own homes and their own businesses and their own recreational pursuits. You know, that's another big source sometimes of things going overboard on your recreational vehicle, your boats. We don't necessarily think about that so much, but there's so many different sources, and every one of us probably contributes every day without even realizing it. So that's, you know, what we're hoping to try to educate people about, the different ways that they have an influence on this.
Doug sent an email from Rice Lake, and I had mentioned Lava Soap earlier and how it felt back in the day when I was a young guy. But Doug from Rice Lake called to say he understands that Lava Soap does not contain microplastics, so I don't want to... I don't want to have everybody who uses Lava Soap stop using it. Man, Eric in Luxembourg, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
I heard you talking about not being able to filter it out of the wastewater treatment plants, and also not really being able to filter it out in your water supply facilities. Will a reverse osmosis filter in your home water for your drinking water, will it take all the microplastics out?
Yes, definitely. That reverse osmosis can take off everything, I think, including the salts, right? So the microplastic, nanoplastic can be filtered by the reverse osmosis or even the nanofiltration membranes. But for the wastewater treatment plants, so a lot of them do not have like the delicate filters that have the pore size similar to RO or nanofiltration or ultrafiltration. Sometimes it's like just like a ordinary like a sand filter or carbon block. I think that's already the most advanced, but a lot of do not have that, right? There's just sedimentation, and then the waters flow out.
Yeah, that makes sense. Eric, thank you very much for calling. Hey, you're safe. If you got it, if you got the reverse osmosis in your home, that's working for you. Karen in La Crosse emailed to say they just looked at the label on their bottle of Barkeeper's Friend. The label notes oxalic acid as an ingredient, and other ingredients aren't listed. They also have an old container of a cosmetic product called Pernox. It's a face wash for oily skin, and this product lists the ingredient abradant polyethylene granules. It's apparent that consumers need to know more about the components in consumer products and their impact on our shelves and our environment.
Yeah, so polyethylene is a plastic, and that item, businesses can no longer create an item like that one she currently has. So it is an older product, yes.
Throw that one out, Karen.
You know, but the reality is everywhere is somewhere. Nowhere is away. So it goes to the landfill, the container degrades, and... You know, it will always be with us in one form or another.
I mean, how long will these things last? I mean, I suppose it depends on the plastic.
Hundreds of thousands of years. So it's very long. They can break down into like smaller particles by the mechanical force of the sunlight and radiation because of the defects. But as to make it fully converted into like monomer, their precursors, will take a long time, like because in the nature we do not have the microbes that can like decompose this like man-made, like recently made stuff. So you consider the short history of plastic like about 100 years compared to other stuff, right? So it's a very short time. The nature need to take at least thousands of years to develop, to evolve the microbes that can decompose them.
Yeah, they can, you know, I know there's some greenhouse gases that microbes can get at and eat up, but they've had a long time to evolve to deal with it. So there you go. David in Verona, your turn. Hi, David.
Hi, Larry. Your guests are doing a great job of explaining how microplastics are accumulating in the Great Lakes and in the environment, but they seem to be backing away from talking about any health or environmental consequences of them because there isn't enough information. But the whole point of having this show is to that we think that this is a bad thing. I mean, nobody is really advocating that we should have more microplastics in our lakes and environment. Why don't they say that this is something that should be stopped?
Yeah, all right. Well, Oren, what do you think?
So I didn't talk about more about the toxicity or the environmental hazards of this microplastic because I'm not a toxicologist. I'm an environmental analytical chemist. And actually, in our team, we have Gavin Dannert from Wisconsin Seagram. He is a toxicologist. See, I think if he is on the show, he will have tons of things to say about toxicity. So actually, there are tons of literature reporting the toxicity of microplastics. Not only the direct health, like toxicity to some living creatures in that water, but also the ecosystem risk, right? So when you have, so think about a plastic. If you have 1 millimeter plastic particle, it can degrade into 1 million, 10 micrometer particle, right? So when this particle like just accumulate in the water, so it could shift some like maybe the living creature population or community, not only in the water column, but also in the sediment, because there are a lot of plastic are like heavier than water and just go to the sediment, like the PVC, like, right?
That makes, and Jenny, I mean, that's kind of, you know, to David's point, that's kind of, we have a ton of research out there. And the reason you're doing the work that you're doing is because you think, you know, that there are health, human health and environmental concerns that need to be addressed, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I would agree that we're aware that there's concerns here, right? And that's one of the reasons we're trying to make people more aware of some of these issues. I would say that part of the my hesitation is also the philosophy of the organization that I work for. Mm-hmm. So Wisconsin Sea Grant is based in research, education, and outreach, not advocacy. And so there are other organizations whose mission is to put forward a specific solution and advocate for that solution. That's not Wisconsin Sea Grant's role. Our role is to provide information to others so that they can make decisions for themselves and their families and those they come into contact with. And we don't serve an advocacy role.
You do serve an education role, though, and I was thinking about you mentioned earlier with fashion, and your grant funding, as a matter of fact, will help teach fashion school faculty and students how to reduce polyester clothing fiber waste.
Yes. So it's sort of a fine line here, you know, and I acknowledge that of, you know, is education advocacy? In some ways it is, right? The topics you choose to talk about, you're choosing them for a particular reason. But I guess the politics of it, we try to stay saying you should do this or you shouldn't do this. We're trying to inform people of the different impacts and the different things to think about as opposed to telling them what to do or what not to do.
Yeah, okay. Paul in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Larry. Great program today. And I just wanted to follow up on a couple of the callers' observations about, you know, why don't we do something about this, or don't we know enough about this to do something about this? And about 15, 20 years ago, I began a project in Madison which had to do with recycling consumer waste generated at events, which was, you know, plastic bottles and aluminum cans and that sort of thing. And the biggest question that people that volunteered to help on this was, why can't we recycle this kind of plastic bottle or this kind of plastic cup? And I think that was pretty well answered earlier because of the chemical makeup of these things. They don't always break down the way that they got built up, so to speak. But the point is that all of these things, whether the university researchers are doing advocacy in the political ring or not, they are all political activities based on laws. And these laws will not get changed unless individuals take up this as their life's quest. I mean, I've made recycling my life's quest, and, you know, I'm as guilty of mishandling consumer waste as many other people, but it requires a huge commitment by every individual to actually advocate to their representatives and tell them that they want laws that will change this. There are many organizations representing big industries that are lobbying the legislature and the federal government all the time to keep their business models in place so that they continue making more plastic. And yet, on the consumer side, there is nowhere near as much muscle. And
yeah, I think you're right. You may well be right, Paul. And I want to get a comment from our two guests with just a quick reminder. I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about earning a degree as an older adult, and then we discuss what it takes to be a substitute teacher. So that'll be interesting tomorrow. Right now, we're talking about an interesting topic as well, and that's microplastics and the research and work that's going on at Horan Way from the Environmental Chemistry and Tech Program at the UW-Madison College of Engineering, and Ginny Carlton from the Sea Grant program at UW are doing. And Paul had made a nice comment or a comment. I wondered if you could react to his comment. Ginny, start with you.
So he was talking about recycling campaigns, and one of our educational kits expands what is commonly known as the 3 R's, reduce, reuse, and recycle, to 8 R's. And I just want to show you, obviously your listeners can't see this, but we have made on plastic a variety of display cards that says rethink your choices, refuse single-use items, reduce consumption, reuse everything, refurbish old stuff, repair before you replace, repurpose and be creative, and recycle as your last option. So often we think about, oh, I'm just going to recycle it, but perhaps you might not purchase it in the first place if you're rethinking your options. So a variety of different things that we're sharing with our school children, with our educators, with non-formal educators, and anyone we come across.
Yeah, for sure. And Warren, a comment?
Yeah. My comment is maybe rudimentary. It's just the recycle. It's recycling is a great thing to reduce microplastic in the environment. Yeah. And
anything you can do to get rid of it in a proper way.
If the microplastic already in the water or sediment, it's really hard. I mean, if it's in the water column, probably you can build a robot to filter out all this plastic, but for the smaller ones, it's going to take energy, right? So take energy to filter the water, because you need to have a small size, pore size of membranes.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about climate change, and I know that the expert, Rob Jackson, has pounded away in his book at saying it's a whole lot cheaper to stop it before it begins than to, like, pull the carbon out of the air. And it's the same with microplastics or probably anything else. It's always cheaper to stop it before it gets there.
Yeah, yeah, definitely from the perspective of thermodynamics, right?
Kurt in Poinette has a question. Hi, Kurt.
Hello, Larry and guests. My question is, I live in the rural county, Columbia County here, and I have a well water. Is my well water safe from these plastics?
Private wells. That's a good question, Kurt.
I think it is safer than public water, right? So it's because the groundwater usually, it's hard for the microplastic to penetrate. Penetrate the sand, the soil, and eventually reach the groundwater aquifer and get into the well. Compared to surface water, it's cleaner from microplastics.
Is there any kind of a test that Kurt or anybody else could, you know, say, I want to check and see if I've got in my private well water or in my public water?
I mean, test for microplastics.
Yeah, if I could, you know, somebody like Kurt, could he, you know, fill a glass of water and then, you know, put something in it that's going to tell him?
We can do that, but it's expensive. For
okay.
Now. Yeah. It's particle analysis. It's not like the chemical. Right?
Yeah.
The chemical, like, we can do it, although it's also expensive. but for particle is harder. Yeah.
Mike from Madison emailed to remind that reverse osmosis water system use store filtered water in a pressurized tank that has a plastic and or rubberized liner. And this may introduce plastics back into the drinking water.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, there's really no getting away from plastics in our livelihood. And, you know, today we've been suggesting that they're bad, but they're not all bad. We rely on them for so many things. You know, our healthcare industry is built on plastics. We use them for IVs. We use them for the
needles.
Syringes for our shots. We use them, you know, in little all different kinds of things. Safety. We used to have glass bottles of shampoo for our bath, and now we have plastic bottles. So there's so many good things that we have going for us because we have these plastics available. They're lighter weight, so our cars are lighter and more fuel efficient. It's just trying to think about how we're using them and why we're using them, and is this the best thing to be doing in this particular instance, or is there something that we might think about as an alternative?
And, you know, and as individuals, as you were talking about earlier, I think I mentioned, you know, you can buy 100% cotton or 100% wool clothing, as an example. You can dispose of plastics properly, as we were talking about. You can perform car maintenance on a regular basis, and that helps with the tires and the other parts of the automobile. Rethink how you do your laundry a little bit. Maybe do it less often, maybe, with larger amounts. A lot of things that we can do, and it's been a pleasure talking with you today. I appreciate it very much, and look forward to another chance to visit with you. Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Larry.
So, Horan Wei from the UW College of Engineering, Jenny Carlton from the Wisconsin Sea Grant Program, talking about their research on microplastics. And coming up, we're going to take a look at reducing greenhouse gases and the whole climate change issue with the author of a new book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking now, taking a look at reducing greenhouse gases. And our guest is Rob Jackson. He chairs the Global Carbon Project, is a senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment and Precourt Institute for Energy, and a professor of earth science at Stanford University. And he's the author of a very new, with a new book, a very interesting book and very readable book, I might add as well. I really enjoyed reading it. It's called Into the Clear Blue Sky. Subtitle is The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere. And I hope you'll join in as we talk with Rob. What do you want to know about reducing greenhouse gases? How can we remove those gases already in the environment or atmosphere? And what about warming the planet? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Rob Jackson, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in today.
Great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
You know, we were just talking about microplastics on the show and some research that's being done on microplastics and how much exists in the Great Lakes. It's a terrible amount. And the one of the comments was, well, it'd be it's a whole lot cheaper to stop them from going in than it is to get them out once they're in there. And that's kind of like your book. You've got a couple of sections in the book, sort of. One is emissions first and the other's drawdown last. How essential are these different approaches to reducing greenhouse gases?
I think they're all essential, and your plastics analogy is a fascinating one. It's a topic that we're just learning about, really, in the past 5 or 10 years, and how prevalent it is, not just in lakes, but across the world's oceans, too. But the same thing does hold for greenhouse gases. It's always cheaper, safer, and easier to keep pollution from entering the atmosphere than it is to try and suck it back out of the air using energy. I sometimes use the analogy of a blot of ink. It's easier to blot ink with a tissue on your pen than it is to get it out of your pants or to remove it from a swimming pool or a glass of water. And the same thing's true for greenhouse gases. It is technologically possible to remove gases from the air, but it's not really cost-effective or energetically desirable. That makes more sense. Do it at the point source. Do it now, not later.
You know, I loved your book. Well, maybe talk about what your book is about. I mean, you go to a lot of different areas, talk with a lot of different people.
Yeah, I think of it as a repair manual for the planet, a how-to guide for restoring our air. And as we journey from climate despair to climate repair, and that was true for me personally. I'd spent decades tracking greenhouse gas emissions through my work, through the annual updates we provide with the Global Carbon Project. And I needed hope, too, just like many listeners do. So after years of watching climate in action roll by like floats in a parade, I went looking for hope and solutions. I visited CEOs around the world, companies making the first steel fossil-free, scientists magically removing carbon dioxide from the air and turning it into stone within a few years, much faster than we expected, and lots of individuals, people, and companies just cutting emissions today, saving forests, transforming the way we travel. And there's just so many good things happening. I could have provided a completely different set of examples. And that's the source of hope for me. There's the great things happening today. We can't lose sight of it.
Yeah, they are. And it was really interesting to learn about them in your book and fun to have that personal kind of approach there and talking with those individuals. I really enjoyed it. Well, which greenhouse gases should concern us the most?
The two we care the most about are carbon dioxide, which gets the bulk of attention, and rightly so. It's the dominant gas warming our Earth. It's also very long lived in the air. It lasts for thousands of years once it's there. But I focus in the book on methane, the second most important greenhouse gas for warming. It's not quite as strong right now. in terms of the warming it's caused, but it's much more potent pound for pound or ton for ton. And it also, critically, only lasts about 10 years in the air. And that means if we could somehow magically reduce emissions today, the air would go back to pre-industrial levels within a decade or two. And that's how what I use the term restoring the atmosphere to mean. Doing that would save us a half a degree C or a full degree F of warming. There's no other greenhouse gas that provides such a strong lever today.
And here we are with the chapter that you the chapters that you wrote about when it came to our use of natural gas for heating our homes and for cooking. I gotta tell you, when I was reading through, you know, your testing and that at that lady's home, I was thinking, oh my goodness. Because I have an electric oven, but I've got a gas top. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. In fact, we had the same until a few years ago. I actually switched the appliances in our home because of the testing that we did. We pulled we pulled these instruments into my house literally in weeks, tested the equipment that we were to use to measure NOx gases that trigger asthma. We were the first group to measure benzene emissions from this. And seeing those pollutants formed literally the minute I turned the oven or the burner on was enough to make me act even beyond the climate consequences of the methane that leaked to the air. But maybe first, just briefly context. Natural gas is a clean fossil fuel. It's the cleanest fossil fuel we have. Wisconsin has reduced its gas use in electricity. Reduced its coal use and picked up some extra gas. So it's better and cleaner than coal. But gas is still dirtier than pretty much anything else we use today, unless you're one of the billion people in the world still cooking over wood or dung. And I doubt many listeners to this show would fit into that category. So I acknowledge the importance and the benefits of gas, but today it's one of the sources of pollution that we breathe indoors that we don't have to. And so I favor, for not just climate reasons, but for health reasons, phasing out coal and gas use.
Yeah, I was interested in the fact that a lot of that methane is, more methane comes out from leaky pipes and so forth in our country than when we actually turn the stoves on. I see there was a lawsuit in just the Washington Post this morning had a story about a lawsuit in Massachusetts, Maynard, Massachusetts. You may be familiar with that, where a leaking natural gas pipe that the company knew had been leaking since 2018 blew up a house in 2021 and killed the father. And so now there's a huge lawsuit about that. But you did write about your work checking those pipes.
Yeah, we did the first studies of mapping natural gas leaks across cities. This was work with my friend and colleague Nathan Phillips in Boston. We drove cities like Boston, Washington, D.C., and Manhattan, literally block by block, up and down, over and back like a lawnmower, and mapped thousands of leaks in each of those cities, four leaks for every road mile. Each of those leaks is a possible source of explosion, and each, of course, is a greenhouse gas emitting source. In D.C., we even called in a dozen sites where concentrations in the manholes were explosive. We called them into the utility. The utility grilled us about what the heck we were doing and sort of why we were poking around. And then we went back 6 months or a year later, tested them again, and about three quarters of them were still explosive at that time. So they really don't take such things seriously. That's not fair. The utilities and the people who work there do care about their safety, and the pipeline networks are better today. But you know, once again, for health reasons and for climate reasons, we can't afford decades more of fossil fuel use. And electric appliances, induction stoves are better, faster, and easier to control now.
Mary Kay in Kenosha has a comment or a suggestion, perhaps. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I have five suggestions. The first one is to filter the buildings, you know, buildings that are apartments, homes, businesses, filter them with either natural air and a filter during the winter. Okay. Second one is we need kits to convert our gas-powered lawnmowers to electric engines. Okay. You can buy the kit and just keep the lawnmower you already have, but convert it. The third one is drip irrigation. Okay, you can eat the entire plant. You'll have less food waste, and you'll have healthier people. The fourth one is copper pipes installed in homes for clean water.
Mary Kay's giving us comment on those, Rob Jackson.
Gosh, I need a class. Thank you, Mary Kay. The first one, filtering the air in buildings, filtering can work for particulates. And some stoves have those vent hoods across them that have those wire filters. Filtering will work for particulates, but filtering cannot help us with pollutants like carcinogenic benzene and asthma-triggering NOx gases. Those are molecules in the air, and we don't have a filter that works for those. So I don't think that's a viable solution for indoor air pollution that we're seeing come off the flames of gas appliances. You're completely right about lawnmowers. I would add leaf blowers to the mix. Gas diesel-powered leaf blowers are amazingly dirty in terms of the pollution they add into the air. I mean, they're worse than cars because our cars are so much cleaner than they used to be. I don't know anything about kits to replace a gas lawnmower to an electric version, but just don't ever buy another gas-powered lawnmower or leaf blower again. Drip irrigation, 100%. I live in California. I grew up in Chicago in the Midwest. So we need drip irrigation more out here even than you do, but it helps everyone, saves money, saves water and energy. And copper piping, I don't study copper piping, so I'll probably pass on that one.
All right, Gary, there you go. Hart and Baraboo, we go to you. Hi, Hart.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for the show. Always a great show. Professor, great topic. I'm a little far afield, but the question I have is, as we're supposedly going to be reducing pollution by, you know, moving to an EV transportation network, the biggest concern I have is the batteries and the rare earths that are part of this whole process are typically produced in China. And the Chinese have a horrible track record in terms of what they're doing to the environment, such as Myanmar or Angola. How do we mitigate that kind of effort? I mean, they don't really seem to care very much about environmental regulation.
Yeah, great question, and it is an important issue that I would say we don't have, you know, 100% of the answers that we need. First of all, we need to be cleaner, better, ideally to have more domestic sourcing. And it isn't just in China that those rare earth metals come from. They come from Africa and other places where the labor conditions may not be very good. There are a lot of fossil fuel facilities being built around the world that don't use ideal labor practices either. But your point is well taken, and we need to make sure that the sources of materials that we use are as clean, that people are treated fairly, that are using them. There are many studies now showing that EVs are better than gas-powered cars, even for states that have a fairly high portion of greenhouse gases producing their electricity. So your point's well taken, but I believe the transition to EVs is still worthwhile. And then just one last thing to say is the only thing better than buying an EV is just not buying a car at all, right? I think using less is not something we talk about in the climate space enough. So we can walk. I bike to work. I'm lucky to live close enough to bike, and you can take mass transit. So not buying a car, not buying an EV is better for the environment than buying an EV. The same is true for a gas-powered car.
I recall you mentioned somebody had written to you and saying, well, I don't remember the exact words, but if you're so high and mighty, what are you doing yourself? And those were two of the things. There were other things that you mentioned that you were doing.
Yeah, I actually biked into my office today because we're having solar panels put on our home, and I was sitting at my desk at home and listening to the drill in the roof, and I thought, oh, I can't do this. But I do have personal anecdotes in the book where I do try and walk the walk beyond just talking the talk, and have cut our own emissions, my wife too, substantially. There are things like flying that are still large sources of pollution in my life and in many Americans' lives that we take for granted often. But otherwise, you know, there are a lot of people doing a lot to reduce their personal footprints. And then, of course, we need systemic changes at the scale of industries too.
Our guest today, Rob Jackson, he is the author of Into the Clear Blue Sky, subtitled The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Rob Jackson. Rob is a professor of Earth Science at Stanford University, among other things, and he has written this fascinating new book. It's a Bill McGibbon called it a fascinating look into some of the cutting-edge climate solutions. And the title of the book is Into the Clear Blue Sky, The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in. I wanted to go back just a minute to batteries and electric. You had a pretty cool ride on an electric motorcycle. And I think you said, I'm not sure, I may have this wrong, but I thought you said there were more people using motorcycles in the world than were using automobiles.
Yeah, I don't remember if that's
exactly.
It's pretty close to there. I think we in the United States, because our distances are greater, our weather's not always great, and especially in Wisconsin, you've got winter. It's hard to commute on a motorcycle in Wisconsin. But there are countries where 90% or more of families use, own, and commute on motorcycles. So I like to ride motorcycles and bicycles, and I was fortunate to be able to test drive an electric motorcycle from a company called Zero. They are the world's largest manufacturer of motorcycles, homegrown here in the U.S. They're California based, and that motorcycle was the fastest, literally, and the greatest acceleration thing I have ever driven of any kind. Faster than a car, faster than sports cars. It was amazing. So it was fun, and the CEO who I interviewed talked about how they don't really discuss the climate and green aspects of their product. They sell it based on performance, and the term that he used, I quote in the book, was something like, we're almost tricking kids into eating their vegetables.
Well, and if you look at the amount of tailpipe emissions and the damage that it does, I mean, it kills, 50,000 people every year, something like that.
Yeah, the reasons for acting on climate and choosing clean and green energy isn't just some future generation like our grandkids. It's our health today. Our water and air are better quality than when I was a boy, but pollution from coal and cars still kills 100,000 Americans a year, at least. And one in five deaths, 10 million people worldwide die from fossil fuel pollution. That's 10 million senseless deaths a year that we no longer need. So the health reasons are even stronger than the climate reasons, in my view.
Yeah. Rebecca in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm so glad that your expert is here to talk about this really important topic. I personally am in the climate despair stage still, so it's nice to hear an expert has hope about ways that we can repair our environment. I'm wondering about different ways that we can try to influence our friends and our neighbors to take action. I'm still surprised when I go to the store and everybody is still using plastic bags to take their groceries out. And I just feel helpless about that. So I'm wondering if you have any tips.
Well, regarding grocery bags, I know I'm in a relatively liberal state, but we have a law here that you have to pay a dime for a grocery store bag. And that it's amazing how a small financial incentive makes people bring their own canvas bags to the grocery store. So it's natural just to keep them in your car when you walk into the grocery store or any store. You just grab the bags and you don't need that plastic. You don't even have to decide paper or plastic, which is better, which is a different conversation. You just use whatever you have and you use it again and again. The despair part, I'm sorry to hear that. My introduction in the book interviews some young people who I think are particularly suffering from the mental health consequences. They feel like they don't feel like they know that they will be dealing with and tackling this issue for their whole lives. They didn't cause it. And they're looking at us with some anger and frankly some despair. It's a really serious issue. I'm sorry to hear your state of mind. I hope my book helps. IntoTheClear.com is the book's webpage. So please read it and reach out if you feel like it.
Yeah. Thank you, Rebecca, for calling. Dave in La Crosse, we'll go to you. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I got two things I want to talk about. One was I'm very disappointed when I go to the gas station and they've got these pop bottle shaped recycling things right next to the garbage cans. And the garbage cans are filled with aluminum cans, which recycling aluminum saves an enormous amount of energy. And the other part is as we become more affluent, I don't see anybody really trying to save. I see more trucks that don't get used as trucks on the road, and people just don't really seem to care. They don't get it until it affects them directly.
Yeah. Comment on that, Rob?
Sure. I fully agree with you, Dave. I think a couple of things I'll touch on briefly. I think in another generation or two, people will look back at us and marvel at the way we surrounded ourselves with plastic in our drinking and food containers, now that we know the pollution that's in them. And I should say, I was trained as a chemical engineer first. My first job was with the Dow Chemical Company. So I know many people in that industry and know many people who care a lot about the environment. But I think people in the future will not understand why were they doing this to themselves voluntarily. Your point about throwing things away is great. Recycling an aluminum can is better than not recycling it, but it's still energy intensive to recycle. So reusing is the best solution. I have a whole section of the book on using less. I think everybody has a different three-legged stool, if you will, for climate solutions. My first leg starts with using less stuff to start with. I mentioned earlier in the session that the only thing better than buying an EV is buying no car at all. And that's true for many things in our lives. We in the US use four times the energy that the average person on Earth uses. And we get nothing out of that when you look at health metrics, pollution that surrounds us. I believe we could use a lot less in this country, consume a lot less, and have clear states of mind, less clutter in our lives. But that message of using less and consuming less isn't as exciting for policymakers as let's build something new and build our way out of climate change. So use less is the first leg. Decarbonize or make less polluting the whatever infrastructure is left. And then if we need to, we'll have to, what I call, hack the atmosphere to remove some gases out of the air. But great point, Dave. Use less. You know, don't recycle, but rather than recycling, just reuse wherever you can.
Yeah. Paul in Wauwatosa, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hi. About 15 months ago, we switched and bought a EV car. And it is absolutely the best car I've ever driven. It's fast. It's fun to drive. And I've calculated that our savings in fuel from gas to electricity, looking at the electric bills, we spent about one-third what we did on gasoline for the same mileage. And as an incentive for other people to buy it, it is absolutely the most fun car to drive. So why not buy a fun car that also saves the environment?
Paul, thanks for calling. Rob?
Yeah, great point. You have an EV and you get used to the instant torque, which I think you were mentioning. You step on the gas and the car just shoots forward. So they are fun to drive, and they're better for the environment. They give us cleaner air, and I think they're also a little more expensive now, but the cost to operate is substantially lower, and the companies that are really switching to electric vehicles are companies with fleets of vehicles, and because they know the operation cost is so much lower. So delivery vehicles, most of those operations are going to electric because they're cheaper to operate. A little more expensive to buy today, but prices are coming down, and I think ultimately will be cost competitive, much cheaper to operate, and a lot cheaper to power with electricity than gas at $4 or $5 a gallon.
Yeah. Barbara in Montello, your turn. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, I was wondering if your guest would like to talk about high-speed rail compared to airlines. And I think you can do it electric. I'm not sure.
You can, indeed. Great question, Barbara. And you see high-speed rail other places in the world a lot. You see it in Japan. You see it in Europe. And frankly, if it isn't just high-speed rail, you see better mass transit. You see more effective, better linked and integrated bus systems, train systems. So I do think there's a place for high-speed rail, particularly where populations are dense, maybe in the eastern seaboard in the U.S., you know, the sort of Boston to D.C. to New York corridor. It makes sense. We're building a high-speed rail system in California to go to San Francisco and Los Angeles. It's being built in the Central Valley right now. To be perfectly honest, I'm not sure that's better than just simply building a decent bus system that people want to take. It's very expensive, and we're not sure the balance yet of cost versus the number of users for people who will actually take it. So I love high-speed rail, but we need to be careful that we're spending our money effectively.
Yeah. Barbara, thank you. Laura in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I have kind of a practical, kind of mundane question. I just listened to the woman call and express her dismay about people using plastic grocery bags. And here's my question. So years ago, we stopped using regular, you know, garbage bags. We just don't buy them anymore. We figure we've got all these plastic bags that we're bringing into the house, so we make them do double duty, and that's what we use in all our trash can liners. And we compost all our compostable stuff. And so that's how we handle our garbage. If I stop using those plastic bags, I'm just wondering, what if people do for their garbage? I think the plastic ones that we're recycling like that are better than using the big old thicker garbage bags. But what do ecologically minded people do if they don't have all those plastic grocery bags? How do they handle their garbage?
They use paper, first and foremost. I think it would be better. There's that age-old question, plastic or paper, paper or plastic. And I think the correct answer is whatever you already have. And so if you have a plastic bag, just keep using it. Don't throw it away. And then if you need to use one for trash once in a while, go ahead. Which brings up a different point. Going back to sort of despair, don't beat yourself up over the small things. So, don't sweat the small stuff, as they used to say. You know, focus on the big things in your life, what fuel you're using in your house, how often you fly, how you travel. And if you use a plastic bag once in a while, then don't stay up at night because you used a plastic bag and you feel guilty about it. Just try and eliminate the large sources in your life and focus on those first.
Oh, good points. Laura, thank you for calling. Tom in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. Great show. I was working with old truck farmers in central Illinois doing passive solar greenhouses back when I was in graduate school. And I really thought we would be, you know, I knew guys that were creating hybrid cars in the 60s. And I just thought, well, by the end of the 90s, we'll have all of this stuff done. Everything, at least half of home heating will be solar. And now as I'm driving through Wisconsin and I see solar farms and windmills, I'm thinking, well, it's there. It's just generational, not just a few years or a few decades, but it takes so long. What can we do to accelerate this kind of technology being popular? We need a John Denver and a Jacques Cousteau would be awesome.
Yeah, fantastic question. One thing we can do clearly is what we choose to use individually. And there is good evidence that if you put and can afford to put solar panels on your house, that neighbors see that and copy that, that there's a there's a sort of a tipping point for neighborhoods that positively reinforces the use of these things. But I also think we can't think of climate change strictly from the lens of individual solutions and use. Yeah. There is a lot that we can do personally and should do personally, but we need systemic change. And that systemic change comes from the state government, you know, what incentives are in place to move towards cleaner electricity. We have a law in California that requires all retail electricity be carbon free by 2045. And we seem to be on track for that. And we do have good solar out here, I grant you, and our weather's more mild than it is in Wisconsin. But so the state's doing things, even if the federal government won't act. So I think one of the most important things we can do is to get involved in our city councils, our county boards, and at the state level, as well as voting for politicians who support clean environment and climate action.
Yeah. Todd in La Crosse emailed, wanted you to comment on world temperatures. What would happen if the world temperatures trending up 3 degrees? And then, and this is something you address in your book, would a price tax on carbon help reverse that?
It would. So please don't let the Earth go to 3 degrees C. When you look back at the paleo record, and you have to look for centuries, thousands of years to see the full consequences. We're talking about tens of feet of sea level rise, permafrost thawing, just passing all kinds of tipping points, things that we can't go back at all or very easily. And it's scary to me. My book is optimistic, but it is scary to see how fast we sprinted to the 1.5 C threshold. We're there today. We're essentially there within the next 5 years or so. And 20 years ago, nobody thought the world would allow that to happen. And yet we did. So we have to be careful that we don't get sort of used to this now and sprint towards 2 or 3 degrees C, which we are still doing. Emissions from all greenhouse gases are still going up. And only for coal use worldwide do we see a hint of leveling off and maybe trending down. But so we're still using more, generating more energy, and have a long way to go. And temperature-wise, it's not our grandkids' issue. It's today, right? The hottest days on record were in July of this summer. The hottest year on record was last year, 2023. The hottest decade on record was the last decade, too. So this is here now, and it's already costing us money. Last year also shattered the record for billion-dollar disasters, weather records that NOAA keeps. We had 28 such disasters last year, and we're paying $50 or $100 billion more a year for them than we were a few decades ago. And that means we, like you and I listening to this call, because the federal government pays for that through disaster relief, that comes out of our pocketbooks. So climate change is here, it's serious, and we're paying for it today.
Morris emailed to say that today's discussion seems to be maybe nibbling around the edges without addressing the fundamental drivers of climate change and many other forms of ecological degradation. The driver is growth of both the human population and its economy.
Great points. And I think Morris, you're right in part, and it depends what environmental issue we're talking about. Climate change is not fundamentally about population growth around the world, in my opinion. It's caused by a billion or so people in wealthy countries like the US, like in Europe, now in China and Australia and elsewhere. It's emissions from us, frankly, not from the extra billions of people in Africa that are causing this this problem. But there are many ways that population growth, it isn't sustainable. We're now at 8 billion people on Earth. Growth cannot continue. And the economic growth is also a difficult topic in our political environment and economy. We're not used to talking about using less, as I referred to earlier in the call. We have this growth mentality, and we can't continue to grow forever. And if we keep using more energy, keep building more stuff, then we'll never solve the climate problem, in my opinion. We can't build our way out of climate change. We do have to use less.
Our guest today, Rob Jackson, his book, Into the Clear Blue Sky, The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere. Join in questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Rob Jackson, our guest, his book, Into the Clear Blue Sky. Great to have him with us today. And there are so many things in your book that we haven't touched on, things that people are doing, researchers and others. Fossil-free steel comes to mind. I was thinking, you met the CEO of a company in Sweden, and the first company to produce fossil-free steel. And, you know, if you just think about it, how can that even be possible? But talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, the trip to Sweden was fascinating. And they I want to distinguish between secondary and primary steel. There are steel recyclers who have been using carbon-free electricity for a long time. Some of that happens here in the U.S. But by the first fossil-free steel, I'm talking about primary steel makers that start with ore, you know, mined in the mountains and railed car to an operation. And that's happening in Sweden today. An earlier caller, perhaps it was Morris, mentioned carbon pricing. And the CEO of this company mentioned how important a price on carbon dioxide pollution was for them to undertake this, he called it a journey or a mission. And they are now producing fossil-free steel. They've removed all the coal out of their operation. I visited the blast furnace. You know, there were sparks everywhere. And, you know, this furnace at 3,000 degrees. And they're using clean hydrogen instead. So they've replaced coal with hydrogen. They make the hydrogen using local hydropower. And they burn that hydrogen, and it turns into water as it's consumed. Now, it's a little more expensive right now than making steel the old-fashioned way with coal. It's cheaper for them to produce it with hydrogen because of the carbon tax. So many pricing pollution makes a lot of climate solutions possible. When it's free to pollute, then almost anything extra we do will cost more than free. But they're creating jobs there. They're selling the steel to companies like Volvo, and they're exporting it around the world now. So ultimately, he thinks it'll be the same price, and it will be the norm, become the norm for producing steel. So just a fantastic example of a, sort of a decadal process of how they transform the way they make steel.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Mike in Green Bay's got something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Hello?
Hi, are you there? What's on your mind?
Hi. Yeah, I just had a question about Carbon Engineering. It's a company out of, I think, Vancouver. And, yeah, I was just kind of seeing if your guests had any comments on it. And I think it was just bought by Occidental Petroleum, which is pretty sure Carl Icahn. But, yeah, just any thoughts on it? Kind of seemed like kind of interesting technology that they have. And, yeah, sure, where is it going to go from here since Occidental purchased it? And I think they're kind of leaning towards the carbon credit aspect, but.
Yeah. Mike, thanks a lot. Drawing hydrocarbons out of the atmosphere, that company.
Yeah. So Carbon Engineering was just sold to OxyForce maybe last year, I think, for about $1 billion. It was started by an engineer and scientist, David Keith, among other people. There is a lot happening in the carbon removal space. There are many companies that are being formed. And just this past week, last week, there was a new body, international body formed called the Carbon Removal Registry, and they are forming to check the energetics and how these companies remove carbon from the atmosphere. For instance, it might be easy to imagine pulling a certain amount of carbon dioxide from the air, but if you use a lot of energy to do that, and that energy comes from fossil sources, you might not reduce the net amount. That would be my concern with a with Carbon Engineering's technology. They use a hydroxide. They have to heat that hydroxide up to 900 or 1,000 degrees C, I believe, to get the carbon dioxide back off it. So I would love to make sure that the electricity that they're using to do that process is carbon-free and clean. So the devil is in the details in these carbon removal processes. Having said all of that, I support the development of this industry and trying to make these companies more efficient, bring costs down, because I think we'll need some. We have an extra trillion tons of carbon dioxide floating around the atmosphere. It will be there for thousands of years, warming the earth. So we'll need some removal.
You have a story, a little story in the book about Archer Daniels Midland, which is doing carbon capture storage.
I do. ADM runs the largest biomass-based carbon removal plant in the world. It's in Decatur, Illinois. And they use, they produce ethanol for our vehicles, which is a whole different discussion in climate space. They're making ethanol, but you make ethanol like you brew beer. If you've ever done home brewing, you use the yeast and the yeast ferments the sugars in whatever you're producing the alcohol with, and that bubbles carbon dioxide into the air. Archer Daniels Midland, at their operations there, is capturing that carbon dioxide and pumping it deep underground where it won't contact the atmosphere probably ever and should stay underground for millions of years. And that process is interesting because it's the only carbon removal technology that generates or yields electricity or energy rather than requiring it. And of course, they're collecting energy that the plants have grown. So it's essentially a solar collector, only plants instead of solar panels that gather that waste biomass, and they use that to produce the ethanol. So really, really exciting things happening there. I mean, you're in the Midwest, and ag is a big part of the economy. Not everyone likes the sort of big ag ethanol industry, but I'm an advocate of we need everything in our toolbox right now, and I support that plant and that technology too.
Jeff in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, my comment was, wouldn't it make sense to have a very large increase of passenger rail across the entire continent and using trains that basically can run on electricity, that just be a massive way of reducing the amount of airplane traffic? Isn't that a possibility?
It is a possibility, and it's a great point. I think we take for granted how unusual it is around the world to fly the way that we do. Most people on Earth have never been on a plane once. Globally, plane emissions are about 3 or 4% of total carbon dioxide emissions, but they're a major part of many of our lives. And you're absolutely right, not just for rail, but buses and other transport systems. Other places around the world have good quality buses and trains that everyone uses. Their trains connect to the airport. You know, you get off your plane, you step onto the train, and you go where you need to go. You don't have to take a bus to this terminal that then takes you to another rail that then gets you to, you know, Chicago from Madison or something like that. So the systems are integrated. Many buses and urban rail systems are becoming electrified, but it takes time to make that transition. And like everything, you don't want to rip out a perfectly good bus and take it offline. You want to wait till that bus is at the end of its life and then buy an electric bus instead of a gas or diesel bus. So spot on, mass transit in general, I would say, not just rail.
Dennis in Afton, Minnesota, will go to you. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, hi, everybody. Thanks. A couple points. I want to back up the hydrogen interest there. That was the first experiment I saw in high school numbers of years ago. And it's one of the things I saw at the state fair when the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency had a video of solar being used to produce hydrogen and run tractors that were produced in New Gallus, Wisconsin, by Alice Chalmers. And where is this hydrogen? The electrical vehicle based on lithium is probably a blip to keep hydrogen off the market, that we don't need to keep driving people off the land with the use of force. This is extremely hurtful to people. The reporters are giving their lives to cover the story about lithium being taken from the ground to produce poisoned areas and harm and much harm to workers. Secondly, as the author looked into what not just individuals can do, but what can we do? We're as supporters of the military bases, 800 bases around the world in 80 countries. What waste and ruin do they have in comparison to our light bulbs and plastic bags? We need to look at everything here, and I hope the author has given some thought to that. I thank you, and I'll listen off the air here. Bye now.
Yeah, great question. Maybe 2 points I took away. One was the military, and the other was hydrogen. Let's take those. First of all, hats off and a nod to the military. The military has done as much or more of any group in the federal government to use renewables and to cut their footprint. And they do it for practical reasons. You know, if they're sending a group somewhere remote, they can use solar panels, set those up, and generate their own power. So they have practical reasons to want a green transition, and they're doing a lot. So a shout out to our military for the progress they've made so far. And then hydrogen, I completely agree with you that hydrogen will be a major part of the clean energy economy. I disagree with you a bit about the relative balance of hydrogen cars versus EVs. I think EVs ultimately will be the winning technology. I love hydrogen for large industrial sources like the steel plant we discussed earlier, where you make it on site, use it on site. Hydrogen is the world's smallest molecule, so it leaks out of everything even more than methane and natural gas. So I think we have to be very careful when we think about putting hydrogen into millions of miles of pipelines and millions of vehicles. Each of those points of operation is going to leak hydrogen to the air. Hydrogen isn't a greenhouse gas itself, but it extends the lifetime of methane and other greenhouse gases in the air. So I like hydrogen for large industrial sources best, less so for cars and putting it into the pipelines running to our homes. But I'll still take it. As I said, you can't, you have to support pretty much everything at this point. So I don't want to be down on hydrogen. I like it.
William in LaGrange, Illinois, emailed to say that China is experiencing air pollution problems and has been installing massive solar arrays as a result. And he also wonders if you knew about the massive lithium deposit in Utah that was just announced.
I do know something about it. I just know about it as it's been announced, and also other deposits in Nevada and here in California, too. There is a lot of lithium and other elements in the United States, and it's a challenge to be able to mine some of those deposits, which is also a different issue for discussion, just as it's a challenge sometimes to site new transmission lines that we'll need to link up our solar and wind installations. We do have good resources here. I think ultimately we'll use them some more. What was the caller's other?
It's slipped my mind as well. Well, let's move on. Brad in Osceola, your turn. Hi, Brad.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I just wanted to apprise the author of another book that I just read recently. I know he's trying to push his book. It's called Fire Weather by John Valiant. And it's a pretty eye-opening book about climate change. Also, I have my other question got answered here just recently about the military and how much CO2 is produced, you know, building armaments and having wars and maintaining the big military structures that we have. So
yeah.
I guess that's about all I have. So.
Okay. Yeah.
So yes, I'm here hawking a book, but I'll plug Fire Weather. That's an excellent book. For those of you who don't know it, it's about the fires that race through the tar sands region of Alberta. I forget the name of the city, maybe Fort McMaster. It's almost a thriller. And the interesting thing about it for me is that it isn't a book about climate change, but it highlights how drought and warmer temperatures is making fires in that region more severe and unmanageable, essentially. The book tells the story of the city holding a news conference at 10 in the morning saying, we think we can manage this fire. And by 1 o'clock, the embers had jumped the Athabasca River and 1,000 homes had burned. And they had just never seen anything like that sort of fire. So it's a link between the severity of fires now with hotter and drier weather and the consequences for us today. And then the book goes on to discuss how they got thousands of people out of the city and how lucky they were that no one was killed in that fire.
What I like about your book is that, you point out the problems, you point out a lot of the solutions, and it's optimistic a bit.
It is. That was my goal. And I think optimism and hope are muscles that we exercise. My first homework assignment in every class is for students to go home and find something in the environment that's better today than it was 50 or 100 years ago. And that list is quite long. It's a decline in global poverty. Our air and water quality are better. Childhood mortality is better. And we're living longer lives. And then there are a long list of things that we've done through regulation that have made us healthier and saved us money. The phase out of leaded gasoline by the EPA has saves us trillions of dollars. It has literally made us smarter because the lead was harming the brains and the intelligence of young people around the world. So that's one example. The Montreal Protocol saved billions of cases of skin cancer and cataracts by phasing out CFCs that resulted in ozone depletion.
So we can do it.
We can do it. And the Clean Air Act is my personal favorite. It's, 30 years of bipartisan legislation that saves 100,000 lives a year at a 30-fold return on investment. The examples are there. By recognizing them, we make climate examples more likely.
Rob, you've written a great book. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate your time very, very much. Rob Jackson's book is Into the Clear Blue Sky, The Path to Restoring Our Atmosphere. Great to have him with us, and great that we have a great bunch of people producing this program. Producers Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.